And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and we have a special guest in the studio with us today, journalist John Stapleton. John graduated from Macquarie University before working as a freelance journalist in the 1970s and 80s. John worked for the Australian newspaper between 1994 and 2009 and has written a number of works, with the next one called Hunting the Famous, which is a meditation on journalism and writing, due out soon. In 2000, most importantly, John co-founded the world's longest-running radio program on father's issues, Dads on the Air. And after all this, John established the niche publishing company, A Sense of Place Publishing. John, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Oh, pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me. Goodness gracious, we used to say we were the longest-running father's show 10 years ago. I can't believe you've kept it going so magnificently, so it's a splendid effort.
Thank you, John. We feel it's a bit strange, really, having you in the studio.
Well, the shows are so different now. They're much more professional. We used to pound on about the evils of the family court and the child support agency for 90 minutes at a time. Who was listening at the end of 90 minutes? I'm not quite sure. But
we could start by just talking a bit about those early days of Dads on the Air. Back in, was it 2000 that you actually
It was 2000, yeah. I got a phone call from a chap called Rick Torning, or Uncle Buck as we called him. There were a lot of former policemen involved in those early days. Policemen are particularly disturbed by what happens in the processes, in family law processes and so on. They've dedicated their life to the citizen, to the community, and then find themselves basically destroyed in their particularly, it's unexpected really, but you do find a lot of former policemen or current policemen in the fatherhood movement, which surprised me to start with.
So when it was very much dedicated to fathers and fatherhood movement and dads with problems with seeing their children when it started.
We were a bunch of very aggrieved, very unhappy chappies, like really unhappy. And it started off at 2GLF in Liverpool. None of this fancy technology you've got now. We had to, if we had a guest, we had to convince them to come all the way to Liverpool. We couldn't do any international. We did. Eventually, we'd be interviewed all the leading players in the fatherhood movement right around the world. When we began, we had no idea we were part of a worldwide trend protesting the treatment of fathers and separated families. Internationally, Fathers for Justice in Britain had yet to climb the Buckingham Palace or invade the House of Commons. Bob Geldof was yet to speak out. But we were fortunate to find ourselves broadcasting in an era when there was no shortage of stories, as that first small of dads rapidly discovered, like no other subject, family law cuts deep into the hearts and lives of people. The history of Dads on the Air coincided closely also with the evolution of Australian groups such as Dads in Distress, which was formed in the same year. Then it was called the Non-Custodial Parents Party, which is John Flanagan's group, which tries to encourage change through the political process, the Shared Parenting Council of Australia, the Fatherhood Foundation. And we also provided a fresh outlet for older groups such as Lone Fathers and Men's Rights Agency. Dads on the Air was born not just out of a sense of outrage, but frustration with the mainstream media's failure to take men's issues seriously. We were proud to provide a conduit for groups otherwise little heard. At first, we were so bolshy in those early days. I mean, we were we really felt really out of the limb.
Well, I know you you got the boss of the then boss of the Child Support Agency in for a grilling at one time, I think.
We had everybody queued up. The Attorney General came on because it suddenly fell into sync with what the government wanted to do in 2003. The then Prime Minister announced that he was drawn to the notion of shared parenting. And so suddenly we had every major person in the arena, in the Australian government and on the opposition benches, queuing up to come on. And, you know, Kay Hole that ran the report, Diana Bryant, the recently retired family court chief justice, they all came on the show. Philip Ruddock, the Attorney General, my goodness, they all came on. And it was just remarkable. Mark Latham came on. He was hysterical. He put his big clomping boots up on the thing and yacked away about only having one testicle because he had testicular cancer and was perfectly happy to discuss all these different details. And we love Park Latham for that, you know. A lot of those early recordings were all lost. They were stolen out of the boot of a car, Rick Torning's car. So I don't know whether that was deliberate. I don't know why anyone else would steal recordings of a community radio station. And
you used your journalistic contacts, no doubt, to get all these guests. And were you doing most of the questioning in the interviews?
Oh, I did a lot of it. I desperately tried to get a multiple of voices because we were running for 90 minutes. So we really had quite a lot of space to fill. And we had no idea that, you can't really run 90-minute shows, that people's attention span just doesn't run to that length, you know. You know, your packaging now is perfect, but back then, and we struggled so much, nobody knew how to... These were the days when your average person didn't know the difference between a website and an email, had no idea how to upload anything to the net. All of these technologies that you have now. So it was a really incredibly determined feat. I was the only one amongst that initial group that had any journalistic experience. I was working on The Australian and... You know, I think, it was rather unfashionable, to be, you get instantly pigeonholed as a sort of bit of a right winger if you dare to speak up for dads, which I think is an extremely unfair characterisation. But other journalists around the world, John Waters in Ireland is a classic example, have really suffered career-wise because they spoke up. And I think that happened to me. I did a few stories on The Australian about some of these surrounding issues, but the then Chief Justice would instantly complain to the paper and they backed off till I was more or less banned from writing about the subject. So I think they thought it was a good release for me. Yeah. At least I wouldn't be pestering them with all these ideas. We could get it out on air. And I think it was hugely, in a personal way too, for all of us, incredibly therapeutic. You know, we all, most people go through these things, carry with them for years or till the end of their lives an incredible sense of injustice or regret. If only I had said this, if only I had done that, if only I had hired a different expert, if only that judge had been sick that day, whatever, And the truth, of course, is that there's very little they can do that alters it.
Well, it's hard to get these men motivated, I imagine, because the natural tendency is probably to go back into your cave if you've had a bad result. You don't necessarily become a campaigner, do you?
Oh, absolutely. It's the 1 in 10, I forget the exact phrasing, but it's like 1 in 10 may speak up, 1 in 100 may actually do something, 1 in 1,000 actually becomes a sort of activist. And I think the ratios are probably lower than that in this arena because... Well, it was unfashionable for a long time, and the debate really suffered from that. And you know what blokes are like? They're not very articulate. Women speak an average, statistically, of 7,000 words a day. The men speak an average of 1,000 words a day. So guess who's going to win the argument, you know?
Did you have women guests on
lots
the program?
Lots and lots and lots, yes. We made a great effort to make sure that it wasn't... You know, of course, you get labelled with the angry man sticker, so we went to a great deal of trouble to make sure that we had lots of women on the show. And there's been some great women all around the world. Erin Pitsey, who founded literally the first women's refuge in the world, did an absolutely fantastic interview, and Cools from Canada, who founded the first Canadian refuge. They all came on. They all said they did not mean to create a refuge system which so stigmatized and demonized men, and that one of the greatest intellectual sleights of hand of the 21st century is to turn working class males into the oppressor. It's insane. These blokes, if you've spent much time with tradies, you know exactly what they're like. They get up, they go to work, they go to the pub after work, they love their wives, they love their kids, they are decent, fundamentally decent people, and to be demonised in the way that they have is just one of the scandals of what we've lived through, of these recent times.
Well, I think one of the main purposes was to give a voice to those men men that you're talking about, they were able to finally have at least some public ventilating of what was going on.
Yes, well, we also had a bit of problem with a little bit too much ventilating. You know, we ran for a while a forum, online forum, and of course there's nothing more unlovely than a drunken, angry, separated dad at 3 a.m. in the morning cursing the world, and we would plead with them to just stop, and they wouldn't. So we eventually closed down the forums because of that, because you do get this vitriol, and people come up with grandiose ideas about how they can solve the legal system or how they can beat the system, you know, and know what it's like. You've seen enough of it now to know that that it's a difficult terrain to steer, to try and make these issues mainstream, to mainstream the issues basically, and to not be stuck with that label. Not that you should always react in advance to your critics, but it was definitely definitely difficult. You know, there were so many stories. I mean, some of them were just amazing. Here's one, for instance, that we focused on for quite a while. A young Canberra father with three children who was losing 80% of his income in tax and child support died with a letter from the agency in his hand. He gassed himself in his car. The agency, while refusing to give evidence to an inquiry into the man's death, claimed to the media to have been treating him fairly. Another man whose case I personally investigated took more than 2 weeks to die when he swallowed poison after a call from an agency officer. The CSA refused to attend the inquest despite a request from the magistrate claiming privacy legislation. And this is one way now that a lot of this debate around, it's undeniable, and this is one of the great scandals of social public policy in Australia, is absolutely undeniable that the Child Support Agency is very, very closely linked to the high death rates amongst separated men. Mm. We did. I worked on the Australian. We had one of the country's leading freedom of information experts go through the agency. It took him 2 years to get the stats because there was a very common claim back then, 3 men a day suicide from family law and child support. So it was a simple question, is that correct? And so we set out. So we asked the agency, how many of your clients die each day? Mm-hmm. Would not answer.
No.
So this is the CSA saying, you know, helping parents manage their responsibility. Oh, yeah, but you can't count your own dead. Yeah. And so it was a very interesting exercise. As it turned out back then, the statistics would have all evolved now, but that was about 12 a day were dying. And if you compared that to the death rate in the broader population, it was more or less double what you would expect in a similar sort of population cohort. So statistics can be very difficult, of course, and attribution of cause can be very difficult. But I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever, and that is one of the great scandals. I mean, governments fund what they want to find, and they find what they fund. Mm. So there is no funding, there's no looking, there is no public inquiry into this because they don't want to know the answer, because the answer is extremely incriminating.
We're speaking today with John Stapleton, who is a journalist and one of the co-founders of this very program, Dads on the Air.
This is just from an article that we did. We did a short book called Chaos at the Crossroads about the whole thing. In terms of human suffering, the Australian public has already paid dearly for the failure to reform outdated, badly administered and inappropriate institutions dealing with family law and child support, and for the failure of governments to take seriously the experiences and voices of the men and women most directly affected by them. The country's failure to reform family law and child support is ultimately a failure of democracy itself.
From little things, big things grow. So we're still looking for that growth. John has been telling us about those early days of Dads on the Air, and since then, you've continued as a journalist, but you've also set up a niche publishing company, Sense of Place Publishing. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, it's such a fraught domain and such a bottomless pit of pain, that whole arena, that everybody burns out sooner or later. And, you know, even the evolution of your show to so many other sort of related but you know, much more appealing sort of subjects, if you like, are great. Some of the guests you've had are just great. You know, Donna King was an old chief of staff of mine at The Australian, and Stuart Coop, I used to share a house with Stuart, you know. So you've had some great guests, just with those two. Yes, I left full-time journalism. I've been on the loose since about 2010. I was a sort of... I used to bash out stories and write, and, you know, I always wanted to be an author and write, and I used to bash out all this stuff as a teenager, and mounting piles of rejection slips. So I always had this fantasy of, I suppose it was, a retirement project to start a publishing company. I've said a few times, if I had any idea how insanely complex it would be, I would never have started. It's probably not true, but it is insanely complex. Don't think you can just go and start a publishing company out there, because it's not an easy exercise. Of course, now the technology has changed so dramatically that the entire field, like so many other fields in society, has changed very dramatically. And we've entered this strange sort of era where everyone wants to write and no one wants to read. It's just unbelievable.
So you're encouraging authors to send you their manuscripts?
Well, the business model evolved. You know, we expected, we did some things that we thought would be commercially successful, you know. Old mate of mine on the PR guy on the Cotton Foundation, his job was to convince us journalists that cotton was an environmentally friendly crop. So we were mates because it was just so hysterical, the whole situation. And he wrote a sort of boy's own story called Models Behaving Badly, which was, you know, it's not exactly high-flying literature. It had one aim, to sell. But it didn't. We had another book, Travels with My Hat, which was a great book by this woman who was, she was one of the first women in the Middle East running around. We had Ida Buttrose launch it, you know, Australian of the Year Ida Buttrose at Glebe Books, and it got lots of coverage in the papers. We were on Life Matters on the ABC, and it didn't sell either. Mm. I mean, it's just an incredibly fraught and difficult field. We did a great book just recently called She Said, She Said, talk about gender bending, and that was launched by Kate McGregor, who was... But Kate, of course, is the most famous transsexual in the country. Trans woman, she calls herself. And she said was about this woman who was living in the suburbs in Brisbane, had three kids, cute husband. They were a good-looking couple in the day, and as far as she was concerned, they were going to grow old together. And then one day, the worst words in the English language, we have to talk.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear is right. Mm. And so she was so thrown by this, and so perplexed by it that she started taking notes. And the end result was this book, She Said, She Said, which is a great book and really fascinating. And that was launched at Sydney Theatre Company with Kate McGregor launching it, who gave a wonderful speech, you know. Mm. And so that was a real, it was a fascinating sort of bit of gender bending, really, because that same night, Kate McGregor's play...
I remember the Sydney Theatre Company, I think.
Yes. So that was also the launch of that. So it was a hugely visible night for the trans community, and fascinating. So yes, it was all sorts of stuff.
And you've also published your own book, Chaos at the Crossroads, was...
That's going to be redone. That was sort of just in digital when we started. I was sort of experimenting on myself to start with. I'm much more accomplished now. I've got really world-class cover designers and interior layer out and that sort of stuff, which in those days I quite frankly didn't know what I was doing. I would just, as a journalist, you bash out the story and go home, and everything else is somebody else's problem, you know. So whether it's run on the front page or no page, you still get paid, you know. And I was working for a Rupert Murdoch publication, so it can be sort of frustrating, let's be polite. Yes, I've done some of my own books. I did one, Thailand Deadly Destination, because I lived in Bangkok for some years. I'm now banned from Bangkok. I'm now banned from Thailand, which, considering that some of the mafia scumbags that make Thailand their home, is quite a feat.
And currently you've got Peter Vandervoort book. Peter actually was on Dads on the Air as well for quite a long time, but his new book is called Children of the State, Stolen for Profit, and that's published by Sense of Place Publishing.
Yes.
So that's going to be, I think, a Bible for people in this area of working for children, being able to live with their own parents.
Well, I hope you have him on at some future point, because he's very passionate about the whole thing. Could talk underwater about it, of course. We both know Peter. But it requires, in a sense, that sort of level of obsessiveness to actually finish a project like that. Peter never finished high school, arrived here when he was 11, so English is his second language, basically, from Holland. He, had never written a book, had no experience whatsoever in this, but was passionate about this subject and kept going round and round and round in circles. And so it's all my fault, really, because I said to him one day when I dropped by his farm, I just said, well, if you've got so much running around in your head, why don't you just put it down on paper? And so he obsessively sat there day after day, night after night, thinking about nothing else until he finished his book. And now he's just pleased as punch because it's over. And he says he'll never write another one. It was the most difficult thing he ever did in his life, but it's a very proud achievement. So it was good to be able to help someone through that process, you know. So there's a lot involved. I've done a couple of other books recently about Australia and what's going on here. I wrote a book called Workers' Paradise Lost, Terror in Australia, Workers' Paradise Lost, and that got me all the attention from all the wrong people. And then there's a sort of sequel to that called Hideout in the Apocalypse, which is about surveillance in Australia, because anyone who has been particularly active in these areas, does come under some sort of official surveillance. And if you read the history of ASIO and these sort of groups in Australia, they record people like Anne Summers, who's one of Australia's most famous feminists, and a very mainstream feminist, and they record her breathlessly attending a woman's meeting, because it was all considered very beyond the pale back then, Yes, it's hysterical if you read some of the history of it.
I've always found journalists to be the most fascinating people to talk to, and I'm sure we could go on talking about a lot of old stories, but we've reached the stage of the show where we ask our guests to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which song you picked and why you picked it?
Oh, I like this, man. Song, sorry. I played it a bit obsessively late last year, called Wild Man by
Kate Bush.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. And I just played this song obsessively, and it's about and I kind of related to it. I don't know why, but it was about a man, like a snowman, like a yeti or something that was discovered or allegedly discovered in the Himalayas, and the attempts that people made to protect it against the authorities. So, and of course, Kate Bush in her later years has been so beautiful. She's a perfect example of an artist who has pursued a vocation and become one of the finest practitioners in the field ever. And so I admire people who stick to things like that and find a vocation. She's lucky. She found a vocation very early in life and has produced some absolutely beautiful work, so magnificent body of work, and lovely song. I love this song.
Might also have some reflection on your wild days in Bangkok, but here's Kate Bush. You sound lonely. And that was Kate Bush singing Wild Man, specially chosen for us today by our guest, John Stapleton. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now to give a special thank you to our guest, John Stapleton. John, thank you very much for coming back to Dad's on the Air.
Oh, no, I really want to congratulate you for all the wonderful work that you've done. It's a real credit to you, and it's just great to see the whole thing still going.
Well, thank you very much, and we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.